transits from life to life and brings in the psychic being. And then he talks about the survival of the nature in the sense that after making it very clear that it is necessary for the nature to be constantly renewed from life to life, to gather new kinds of experience. He also looks at the fact that there is a certain aspiration towards persistence of the nature within the human being, because there is also an evolution of nature going on. And what he brings out towards the end is that this evolution of Prakriti is not also not merely a cosmic evolution, but like the evolution of spirit, an individualized evolution, an evolution leading to the fulfillment of the person. So, as this entire creation manifestation can be seen as a self-multiplication of the divine person, Purushottama, in his innumerable portions, as Sri Aurobindo says, you know, Amsa Sanatana, it is also a self-multiplication of the divine Para-Prakriti. And therefore it is, as one might, as he puts it over there, the holocaust of the Divine Mother, not only cosmically but also individually. Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta. So both these aspects, the individualization of Purusha as the Amsa Sanatana, individualization of Prakriti as Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta, are represented in the psychic being. Psychic being is that which contains both of these. And therefore, true representation in a life divine has to begin when both these are expressed perfectly in the life. The expression of Purusha in the life takes place when the psychic being can come to the front and can assume the instruments of mental, vital, and physical Purushas as their, as its fully formed, projections and aspects in these three realms of nature. The perfect embodiment of Para-Prakriti in nature takes place through the individualization of nature, creating personalities which can endure and be perfect instruments of the psychic being. So after going through this entire chapter in which he's talking about the emergence of psychic being, firstly of the development of psychic being from the psychic entity through individualized lives, through the life of the jiva, where the jiva is evolving instruments of nature that can endure more and more, can become individualized, can become personalized, so that a psychic being can persist outside of the housing of matter in the life worlds and mind worlds for certain durations of time. Now that is the progress of the individualization of spirit, both in Purusha and Prakriti. Psychic being has the power to organize nature possibilities, its own nature possibilities, and thereby control certain aspects of a vital Prakriti and a mental Prakriti and persist in vital and mental worlds after this material life is done. Now, in saying that, he has brought us into contact with the notion of rebirth and also with the ancient Indian idea of the psychic being as being the true dweller within that persists from life to life. But he doesn't stop there. At this point, he challenges some of the Indian notions of karma and rebirth. What is it that governs as a determinism the life of the jiva after its material life and in its material life? What is the relation between the two? And he challenges the notions because he is creating a more comprehensive and integral picture of this entire process as an evolution of both Purusha and Prakriti. So from that point of view, this determinism has to serve that process. If it doesn't or cannot serve that process, then other explanations have to be seen as serving some other kind of motive of the human nature. And indeed, he points out these motives are motives such as the usual social, sort of tendency towards justice and towards the holding together of the people. You may say it is a mechanism of loka sangraha, holding together of the world. But it is not a truth. It is a kind of human manufacture to aid internalization of certain types of understandings whereby we may keep ourselves ethical. It doesn't serve any evolutionary explanation. So he shows us or provides such an evolutionary explanation. But he provides it in terms of Purusha and its persistence from life to life. It is only right at the end, towards these last three paragraphs of this chapter, that he turns around. In fact, sorry, to complete my previous thought, in making that explanation against karma, he also demolishes the idea that it is a single personality that we are carrying from life to life. The mental, vital personality that gives us our memory of what we are in a certain life, our responses, our feelings, our the stamp of our thoughts, it's a narrow kind of individual formation in nature, which leaves its residue as far as the psychic nature is concerned, but which if it were to persist from life to life, would give us an extremely narrow, rigid angle of experience. Therefore, it is shed. As part of cosmic nature's and individual nature's evolution, it is necessary for each psychic being to experience reality from a variety of nature perspectives, combinations of qualities that give various kinds of, manifestations of the four different Mahashaktis. So, as a result, there is a taking up of an entirely new personality from life to life. A persistence of the shades of vital and mental personality after death, which can only last for a certain period of time. And after that, which disappears or dissolves. Now, last few paragraphs, he is addressing this entire problem from its reverse direction. And that is that an equally powerful aspiration expressed by primitive man, but not something in any way that has disappeared in modern times, is the aspiration for the immortality of the nature. And that is also something legitimate, because it is connected with the fact that nature itself is also a self-individualization of the Supreme Para-Prakriti, of the Divine Mother. Hence, this legitimate aspiration for immortality also has certain conditions that need to be met if it is to be fulfilled. And in these last two paragraphs, that is what he is taking up. In the first of those two paragraphs, he is talking about what is necessary for the mind and the vital to persist. Now, first, this is a special problem of the general problem of persistence of nature, because the material persistence is so difficult that he will not consider it at first. It seems to be chimerical. It seems to be an impossibility. Why? Because the laws of matter are extremely rigid. The laws of matter are automatisms that can be predicted without fail. And it is almost at that level of a law that forms which house life have a temporary existence. They are subject to dissolution, subject to decomposition. And therefore, to consider material immortality is not something that he will undertake initially. Instead, he will look at mental and vital possibilities. The mind and the vital have a much longer persistence and a much more powerful individuality than the physical. The vital sheep has a certain ability to persist and to develop its own characteristics even beyond the physical. The mental sheath, we know very well, can encompass in its own imagination periods of time which will completely outstrip any possibility of the material existence. We think in terms of aeons. We think in terms of the distances of light years. That kind of thinking is possible to the mind. So the mental sheath is something that has laws quite different from that of the physical. It's a tremendous mismatch to have a body that is undergoing its own processes of time, and a mind which has its own sense of time, which is quite, quite different from that of the body. Now, this is why he takes up the possibility of persistence of mental and vital nature as an individual reality. And I draw your attention to what he has to say about it, because it's very important. He says, but this aspiration, and I'm reading from the second last paragraph, but this aspiration could only succeed, and of course this aspiration is the age-long effort of man to discover the elixir of immortality or any means to conquer physically the death of the body. But here he is not talking of the death of the body, he's talking of mind and life. This aspiration could only succeed if the mind, life, or body could put on something of the immortality and divinity of the indwelling spirit. There are certain circumstances in which the survival of the outer mental personality, representative of the inner mental Purusha, could be possible. It could happen if our mental being came to be so powerfully individualized on the surface and so much one with the inner mind and inner mental Purusha, and at the same time so open plastically to the progressive action of the infinite, that the soul no longer needed to dissolve the old form of mind and create a new one in order to progress. So here, what we are being shown is an image of nature formations which are being impacted by a number of forces and also have a certain internal tendency towards decomposition. Everything has a catabolic force acting in it, which is making it tend towards decomposition over time. It is also having cosmic forces acting on it, which are challenging its individual reality. And finally, it's having an evolutionary force acting upon it, which is calling for it to rise to greater and greater possibilities of operation. So, only something which has strong enough individuality, a formation which is distinct, has distinctness enough not to be eroded out of existence into some generality, something which has adaptive capacity enough to interact with cosmic forces and constantly assimilate these forces and at the same time retain its individuality, and something which has evolutionary power enough to unfold new potentia of itself. These are the three capacities of nature, either in mind or life, that are necessary for it to come to a point where it doesn't need to be shed after a certain life and it can continue in another life. Now, the mother points out that these kinds of capacities are the capacities of the nature of the psychic being. This is the reason why what Sri Aurobindo is talking about over here is ultimately best achieved through what is known as the integration of the nature around the psychic being. The psychicization of mind and life give to these instruments sufficient individuality, adaptability, and power of evolutionary possibility for them to respond to the needs of progress and of cosmic enlargement that are made on them both by the psychic being and the transcendent. So this is something that is important to understand. Even the various forces needed are important to understand, because even before we can think about psychicization, we can be aware of what capacities the instruments need to develop if they are to progress in the direction of what nature wishes of them. And finally, he ends this last paragraph, and I think we can reread that paragraph. But first, we can reconsider, if anybody wishes, this second last paragraph also, if anybody wishes to explore it with any comments or questions.
Debashishda, that was a wonderful summary.
Debashish?
Yes, Vin.
I was wondering, has anyone ever done this? You know, persist with their mental and life personality?
Yeah, very much so, Vince. I mean, that is actually something that many yogis have done. Mm-hmm. And that is indeed the way by which yogis persist even into much later periods and forever. We talk about avatars, we talk about yogis as being present even now. But as a matter of fact, know, the way they do it is this particular way. We think about, you know, Vivekananda, for example, coming to Sri Aurobindo, or Christ coming to Sri Ramakrishna. These are all examples of yogis who have persisted with their mental and vital and subtle physical personalities because they have woven them around the psychic being.
Yeah, very interesting.
So, Devashishta, so this persistence means that they have integrated around the psychic being and they are persisting themselves in other worlds. It's not necessary that they may use that persistence to come again into another physical body. They may or may not do that. Is that correct?
Yes. 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 Absolutely.
And the Bashista, how about child prodigies? Are they also, they have left their material frame, but they have held on to their mental frame, for example?
Yeah, actually child prodigies, you see, either some amount of that has happened, or a child prodigy could often be somebody who, you see, there's two possibilities there. As we said, the psychic being does bring certain capacities which it holds in latency in the being. Now, these capacities may actually be deployed in a life, and they may be deployed very early in a life. So it may be that a certain line of progress is continuing in the next life. So that is a possibility. It may also be that it's almost like a prefabricated part of nature which exists in cosmic nature has been utilized by a being. This is also possible. That is, a psychic being may take up a certain part, a portion of already formed, highly developed nature that exists in cosmic nature to come into this life. It need not have been its own. And thirdly, it may be that a certain part of the inner being has been integrated around the psychic being.
Devashishna?
Yeah, Vin.
I'm just wondering about persistence. For instance, Sri Aurobindo was integrated around his psychic and his vital and mental. So is he like persisting now in trying to work on his physical body or trying to work on the supramentalization from those planes?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, about the physical body, it's another matter, because that would depend on to what extent the physical progress has been taken into that particular, world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Sri Aurobindo, immortality of the mental and vital purushas and prakritis, nature formations, the formation of an instrument and its persistence, it goes far beyond just the wrapping of these things around the psychic being. You see, like, that's why he talks about the triple transformation. And undoubtedly, as far as these inner personalities are concerned, he achieved the triple transformation for them. It isn't merely the psychic, nor even the cosmic or the overmental, but the supramental purusha that had taken the inner mental and inner vital sheets into itself. It is only the physical that it had not taken or not integrated.
But the other people that persist might not have done all of that, right?
No, definitely not. But
right,
we're talking about a kind of a, like a minimal a necessary condition, necessary and sufficient condition. What are the minimum necessary and sufficient conditions?
It's conditions for persistence. Yeah.
Of the inner mental and vital sheets. Now, with the physical, it becomes difficult, different. You know, just the psychic is not enough. But, you know, at least for the mental and vital and subtle physical sheets, the psychic integration is enough for the inner being to persist.
Well, thank you. That's definitely food for thought.
Yeah. I had a question actually. After our last week, I think Keka had sent a question, which would be nice to take up before we proceed. It was a question relative to part of the discussion that we were having last time, which Mahesh had raised, having to do with choicelessness and surrender. If any of you remember that part of the discussion. So I'd just like to get that out of the way in case there is any confusion about that.
That would be nice, excuse me, that would be nice to review, because last week I remember there was an echo, or it wasn't. This week the sound is terrific so far.
That's yeah. Funny. Yeah. Yeah, so the issue of choicelessness and surrender, you know, caused some confusion, I think, because you see, the idea of choicelessness can very easily be mistaken as a kind of lack of choice. In fact, that's what it literally means, lack of choice. And so compulsion, which is what bondage to the ignorance is all about, is a choicelessness. See, so you know, to say that one reaches a choicelessness when one is completely free is a term that needs to is maybe not a very good choice of term, and it's a term that needs to be heavily qualified if one uses it at all. Because true freedom is ultimate choice. So now the reason why choicelessness had come in, and because then the question is, what then is surrender? See? Because if the ultimate reality is also a perfect surrender, then what is the meeting place of these two? It has to be, you see, as with all these things, one has to put these two opposites together to understand these paradoxical limit conditions of the avidya. Avidya has got certain limit conditions that seem to be parallel lines that do not converge, that seem to be opposites, and yet the limit condition is a convergence. So it is not so much choicelessness, but pure choice and surrender that coexist. Now the reason why choicelessness, why I had got confused about the whole idea about choice, and I had said that term was, you know, kind of equal to surrender, is because I was thinking about effortlessness, which is also a quality or attribute of what I thought of as choicelessness. Now, effortlessness arises because there is an inevitability to every expression that arises out of the divine consciousness. And the divine consciousness is one in which there is a division between a perfect witnessing of the Purusha and an inevitable execution by the Prakriti that is operating under a real idea. The real idea is the central tapas that is manifesting. And that central tapas is manifesting inevitably because all is mapped to its gaze. See, past, present, and time are mapped to its gaze. And all possible combinations of such a tapas are, as it were, being explored inevitably by this supreme being. See, that's why there is an effortlessness to the manifestation. To experience that effortlessness is the condition of surrender. But at the same time, it is also an empowerment in which one experiences oneself as taking choice. The choice is an act of will. Because every movement of this inevitable Shakti is an act of will. That indeed is the very meaning of tapas. So, act of will and perfection of inevitable choice are the same thing that, you know, as a perfect surrender and an effortlessness. So, does that explain your question, Kripa?
Yes, very much, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, Devashishda, I had a question about probably a little bit of a sidetrack about something you mentioned when you were talking, when you were summarizing the previous paragraph. So you talked about some of the, you know, semi-correct theories, the reasons for them being, you know, in some way loka sangraha. Can you talk about, I recall in the Gita, Sri Krishna seems to generally be in the favor of that kind of, you know, upholding the dharma and loka sangraha. Somehow my reading of Sri Aurobindo is that he really doesn't care too much about it. Can you expand on that? Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, no, not really. You see, there is a difference. I did use the term loka sangraha, but that's not the sense in which Sri Krishna is using it in the Gita. The way in which he's using it in the Gita is to explain why the divine is at all interested in working in the world. He's saying the question that arises, one of the major seed questions of the Gita is that when all is said and done, if he is saying to Arjuna that I am all completely free and have no need of action, then why is he here exhorting this poor tormented soul to go around killing people? So the answer he gives is, I am entirely free. And this actually relates to the previous question to some extent of choicelessness and surrender. I am entirely free, and yet I work in the world for the upholding of the world, to the togetherness of the world, loka sangraha. Okay. So that is given as the motive and the reason. Now, it's only mentioned as if in passing. It's just thrown there like a jewel without any explanation. And then the arguments continue. But that is a very, very important cornerstone argument of the Gita. Why is the divine at all at work in the world? Why is Arjuna being asked to take up his dharma? What is behind dharma? Behind dharma is loka sangraha. Loka sangraha does not mean some human law. Loka sangraha ultimately means dharma itself. Loka sangraha means dharma because togetherness of the world, keeping the world together, is the power of unity, of rhythm, which is trying to manifest itself in the world. In fact, that single term is what gives the springboard for Sri Aurobindo to claim an evolution that is going on, which will ultimately lead to human unity and to the life divine on earth. So loka sangraha is the divine law by which evolution is taking place in this world. Now, when I use the term Loka Sangraha right now, that is in a human sense. That is laws like that of saying that karma is determined by our, you know, kind of a system of reward and punishment, a judgment from life to life, is a human moral law by which we can keep society in check without having to go through the amount of external machinery necessary if we were to assume that mankind is entirely free to do whatever they want. If we don't have any other kind of, sort of rule, to external rule to govern this kind of action, then, you know, we need a variety of inner rules to compensate for it. And this is a kind of inner rule. We internalize certain types of moral, conscience kind of things. And this is one of those. From that point of view, it helps to keep the world together. But it is a human law, not necessarily a truth, not necessarily the highest dharma, but some man-made process so as to help people. And such things can't last forever.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying, Debashisda. This is very useful. So, I guess I didn't catch earlier that Sri Krishna is using that with a much deeper sense than the moral human law. Thank you, Debashisda.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. He's using it in terms of ritam, Vedic ritam, dharma, that is the law of inevitability. That is the law of para prakriti deploying the real idea of supermind to hold everything together.
Shall we read the last paragraph?
Sure.
Bindu, do you want to start?
Sure. If you were talking to me, I'm not sure.
I was saying Bindu, but
wants to go? Josh.
Who all wants to go?
Okay, I'll go. But such a survival could only persist in the subtle body. The being would still have to discard its physical form, pass to other worlds, and in its return, put on a new body. The awakened mental Purusha and vital Purusha, preserving the mind sheath and the life sheath of the subtle body, which are usually discarded, would return with them into a new birth and keep a vivid and sustained sense of permanent being of mind and life, constituted by the past and continuing into the present and the future. But the basis of physical existence, the material body, could not be preserved even by this change. The physical body could only endure if by some means its physical causes of decay and disruption could be overcome, and at the same time it could be made so plastic and progressive in its structure and its functioning that it would answer to each change demanded of it by the progress of the inner person. Then here's the footnote. Even if science, physical science or occult science, were to discover the necessary conditions or means for an indefinite survival of the body, still, if the body could not adapt itself so as to become a fit instrument of expression for the inner growth, the soul would find some way to abandon it and pass on to a new incarnation. The material or physical causes of death are not its soul or its true cause. Its true inmost reason is the spiritual necessity for the evolution of a new being. Then it continues, it must be able to keep pace with the soul in its formation of self-expressive personality. Its long unfolding of a secret spiritual divinity and the slow transformation of the mental into the divine mental or spiritual existence. This consummation of a triple immortality
immortality of the nature, completing the essential immortality of the spirit, and the psychic survival of death might be the crown of rebirth and a momentous indication of the conquest of the material inconscience and ignorance, even in the very foundation of the reign of matter. But the true immortality would still be the eternity of the spirit. The physical survival could only be relative, terminable at will, a temporal sign of the spirit's victory here over death and matter.
So here again, he lays down the conditions by which a physical immortality could be possible. And the conditions are similar to that of what has been mentioned for the mental and physical and mental and vital persistence. That is, he says, the physical being could only endure if by some means its physical causes of decay and disruption could be overcome, and at the same time it could be made so plastic and progressive in its structure and its functioning that it would answer to each change demanded of it by the progress of the inner person. It must be able to keep pace with the soul in its formation of self-expression, self-expressive personality, its long unfolding of a secret spiritual divinity, and the slow transformation of the mental into the divine mental or spiritual existence. So again we find, firstly, all these sheets are subject to forces of decomposition. So that is the first need. Can some means be found for the physical causes of decay and disruption to be overcome? Now the other one he has not mentioned over here. There he mentioned it. That is, the mind and vital have to be sufficiently individualized. They have to have sufficient amount of self-definition. Now, in the physical case, that is not necessary to mention because the physical is already differentiated sufficiently. It is a mold. Each physical being is sufficiently individualized. So then the second thing that arises is, to what degree can the forces of decomposition be counteracted? So that is one challenge. The third thing that arises is that there is a power which is going contrary to individualization. That is the power of constant interaction with the cosmos, changing its form. So the same thing applied to the mind and vital. That is, if you had a very rigid formation, which is the case with the physical, that's why he doesn't mention, from the very beginning, the physical has this very rigid formation. Now that is being impacted by the forces of the environment. To what extent can it change and express something which adapts to these forces of the environment? See, we know in physical nature, such adaptations take a very long time, over many, many generations, to persist and survive. See, the same genetic stock moving to a very, very different climate and environmental conditions completely changes into something else over thousands of years. But that is something as a result of processes that occur in the gene pool rather than in an individual life. Given the fact of the rigidity of forms and their determinisms by material inconscience. Now, apart from that, there is the need of the psychic being to renew itself. So as an expressive medium of the psychic being. So ultimately it is the psychic being that is interacting with cosmic nature. And in this interaction of the psychic being with cosmic nature, it has to be able to adapt in such a way that a constant assimilation of cosmic nature is possible to it. If it is infinitely plastic in such an adaptation, you see, our more plastic parts, like the vital and mental parts, themselves find that they have limitations in this particular matter. We can see that language is a good vehicle for understanding such a thing. You see, we at any particular time. Sorry about that. So, if we consider mental and vital instruments, we find that even there, though there is a certain amount of fluidity, any particular language, and it's a very interesting study, if we actually consider, you know, the history of literary expression, which Sri Aurobindo was very interested in himself, and he writes the work, The Future Poetry, to some extent studying this. The history of literary expression shows us that any highly individualized expression of language has a certain capacity to express certain things. But over time, there is a sophistication of language that comes into existence that can make much more fine distinctions and express subtler things that a previous condition of the language would not have been able to express. Now, however, the language has persisted. There too you find that different kinds of languages have got different capacities. Today, for example, the Sanskrit language is treated as a dead language. Now, one may say, there are historical reasons for that to have happened. But still, this is the case. So too Latin and Greek. And then we find that even among other languages, some languages are more adapted to certain kinds of speech and subtlety than others. Sri Aurobindo has praised the English language, for example, by talking of this very factor, the factor of its plasticity. He talks about the elusive turn of phrase of the English language, how very easily tremendous amount of suggestiveness can be packed into a certain phrase in the English language, which allows it to express very complex things with tremendous economy. So that kind of course, we may say that Sanskrit tried to achieve the similar kind of thing with regard to the yogic life. The vocabulary of Sanskrit is much more adapted to the spiritual life than, say, modern languages. Now, that is the reason why we find that languages become obsolete. They become extinct, or they are overtaken by new languages. This is a certain sign of a vehicle of the mind, a mental instrument, that cannot adapt beyond a certain point. So to have a physical instrument that can adapt to the changing conditions of interacting with the cosmos, constantly change, renewing itself, subjecting itself to internal mutations, is a tremendous achievement. And finally, you have the evolutionary force. evolutionary demand.
The bush is the work.
Hello?
Hi, there was the, we just lost the last maybe 5 seconds.
So, yeah, I was saying that, we're talking about adaptation of the instrument to cosmic forces. This constant ability to expand, adapt, and mutate so as to enlarge one's expressive abilities. It's a very interesting study. I mean, whether on the mental or vital level, and in today's world, more so than ever, as we are moving into a global realm, in which if we are to preserve the gains of world cultures, such a plasticity of mind and vitality is extremely critical. So, somehow in nature's yoga, we are being forced in that direction. So too, as far as the physical is concerned, you see that this adaptability of the body is very difficult, because particularly the body has been rigidly formed due to material determinations, genetic determinations. So to what extent can we stretch it to express not only something adaptable to the cosmic forces around us, but ultimately adaptable to creative needs of the psychic being and of the Purusha and its evolution. Ultimately, we may say that this particular physical form may completely be overhauled. Something completely new may come in its place. That notion is present in spiritual traditions, particularly in the Indian spiritual traditions, where the Supreme Being is seen in alien terms. Man is not made in the image of God in a limited and narrow way, or limited and narrow sense. There is a certain sense that man is made in the image of God, but only to the degree that we have the basic potential within us for evolving into something much more complex than what we are right now. So that complexity, to what extent can the physical being be consciously plastic to that? See, that becomes the question. The third aspect to that has to do with what Sri Aurobindo says in the first chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga. He says, the condition of a material immortality is to be perpetually reborn in time. Now, that's a very, very profound statement, which also relates to what he's talking about here. This adaptability is not merely a cosmic adaptability, but it is a ability to mutate in transcendence, to be able to die and be reborn consciously, to be able to demanifest and manifest forms from moment to moment, by the soul's choice, by the creative power of the divine Shakti. So that kind of mutation ultimately is necessary at all these levels, but it becomes the most difficult at the physical level. That is the last frontier and the greatest challenge that the divine has put in the evolution of consciousness at the individual level.
This mutate in transcendence, it is a very powerful, sorry about the feedback. Does that mean that not only it adapts to the current condition that is given to it, but it actually exercises the dynamic role of the supermind directly, like it is manifesting without any medium, like with no intermediary anymore.
Yes, exactly. Ultimately. Ultimately, that is to be born and reborn in the supramental way, in the supramental body. See, that is ultimately the transcendent mutation, or the mutations in transcendence, is the deployment of the direct will of the supermind to form bodies and dissolve bodies and reform bodies. And you see, that is part of the condition of a divine life.
So that way, like the body itself becomes the part of supermind. Like, I mean, I'm not sure whether I call it supermind. I mean, should call it supermind. What I mean is that today it is like a subordinate or imperfect instrument, but then it would be actually, even in manifestation, it is going to be part of it, like really, in every way.
Yes. Just as we can talk about psychic being as a psychic person, so too we can talk about supramental being as a superman or as a supramental person, having supramental Purusha and supramental Prakriti. And part of its supramental Prakriti is the physical being.
Thank you.
Wouldn't its Prakriti be Para Prakriti?
Yes, no doubt, Vince. It is Para Prakriti because at that level, it is supramental Purusha and supramental Prakriti that are manifesting in individualized forms. So each jiva is an expression or a name and form of Purushottama Para Prakriti or Ishvara Shakti in the world, so to say, in divine life on earth.
Oh, thank you.
Debashita, can you explain what it means to be perpetually reborn in time? That means, what do you mean by death? Is it, it's not a death that we see these days, right? It's not like a passing on of the soul. So what does that mean?
Well, what it means is actually, the statement is has got ramifications that are not merely occult, but also philosophical. Because time itself can be seen in two dimensions or two directions. One is as a constant flow and a perpetual flow, that is an eternity without beginning and end, which is a reality of time. But if time is to manifest as quanta, then it has to exist in terms of beginnings and ends. And so the power of the creative power of Shakti must enter into appearances and disappearances. See? So these appearances and disappearances are the discontinuities from life to life. Right now we experience it as a compulsion. So we experience a compulsion of a certain life with a certain form. That form has a certain degree of expansion and development, but the form also has limitations. That's why it is constantly being impacted by the forces that are trying to whittle it away and challenge it so it can't persist beyond a certain point. Now, if we had an infinitely adaptable physical form, then technically speaking, we would be able to persist by interacting with other cosmic entities through that form. Okay, so we are talking about a form that can persist as it is forever. But that is not all there is. The fact is that the entire cosmic creation is also subject to the same process of discrete discontinuity in evolution. That is, out of the unknowable is being precipitated new and entirely unknowable principles into the cosmos. Therefore, this whole fact of manifestation is philosophically bounded by processes of appearance and disappearance out of the transcendence. And to make that possible, it has to be possible for whatever body is manifesting here to consciously disappear and reappear as something else. See? In other words, the difference between our condition now, where we are subject to material determinism of death, and the condition where the supermind produces out of material constituents a body that is infinitely, you know, sort of adaptable from moment to its will, not merely as a persistence, but also as a disappearance and a reformation of a completely new kind that has not appeared in the cosmos. That is what I mean.
I just got a thought of, it could be a little off the track, that is there any such thought or idea that this cosmos, like this whole planetary system and things like that, where it's now automated, right? Like we know the Earth and all the planets came actually, their bodies were produced from the sun, and then now they got separated, and now they're in a cycle of rounding about it, and this now it's not conscious of it. The material Earth or material planets, is it possible that there could be a day where the entire, even material universe, would be consciously following the same process or something like that?
Yes, indeed. Actually, yes, both Mother and Sri Aurobindo have talked about it. These would be some of the final culminations of a supramental manifestation in which matter with its own material consciousness would awaken to its divine reality. Then, and it would express it also within the limits of material reality, also having the power of mutation directly accessible to the supramental will.
And also, could you please also elaborate on that, that the play of forces that today we experience, when it would be completely harmonized, that single thread of harmony, could you elaborate on that? I am not being able to exactly visualize. I just thought if you could help.
You mean the part when I was talking about the fact that in our contemporary times, this possibility or this pressure for adaptation, cosmic adaptation, has become more than ever? Is that what you're referring to?
Sorry, yes, in a way. As a part of this dynamic reality, how could it be actually perfect? What is the picture of it?
Well, as far as the cosmic aspect of it is concerned, And you know that, as we said, there is the mind, the vital, and the physical. So the cosmic evolution has taken place in a certain way, in which automatically these three instruments have been socially developed through different cultures. And so that's the reason why we have today very, very different kinds of expressions. Even the definition of what it means to be human is very different if we really look at it. From a certain point of view, we may say all human beings are the same. They are driven by the same kinds of feelings, needs, emotions, etc. But that is only a certain range of experience. It's easy to reduce human experience to that range. But if we are sincere about it and say that we don't want to reduce, but allow every possible experience to manifest itself, then we see that that is very difficult in today's world, because either and let's say that the sign of that difficulty is in the fact that it is almost impossible to fully translate any language and its expressions into another. Languages are ultimately the expressions of certain collective ways of being, and those collective ways of being and experience are not fully reducible to any other. See, so what happens as a result is a certain kind of a dialogue, a dialogic entity, where mental and vital instruments of collective realities are being subjected to pressures. If they are not to wipe out certain precious forms of experience that have developed in the cosmic human being through time. So it is through this process that we are moving towards a certain kind of universality. That universality is a very difficult negotiation. We have by no means come close to the completion of that, what is called the ideal of human unity. But at the physical level, you know, we certainly from within, from the inner being point of view, we have not progressed much at all. But the pressures are being felt nevertheless. And that's the reason why today we have so many new molecular technologies, even at the physical level, to cause adaptations which we don't have, to extend the capacities of the body beyond what it has right now. Now, to be able to have, for example, an instrument which is mentally capable of experiencing to its full the truths of the various kinds of experiences that the cosmos has developed through its history, irrespective of what culture it has developed it through, or to experience the forms of adaptability of the body that the human body has developed through a variety of different exposures to cosmic circumstances, and generalize these throughout the human race while maintaining a certain kind of specificity of choice, would be the direction in which such a kind of instrument would evolve cosmically. I don't know if I'm answering your question or because
actually I could not phrase my question while you were saying. I think the question came out a little more clear, that what is the real difference between a paradise of gods, like where they are in perfect harmony, and the supramental life, there is a life, but it is supramental, not just a heaven.
That is a slightly different question, but also related to this question of human unity and transcendent expression, you see, which we touched on, and which is the essential difference between overmind and supermind as well, which is that human, I mean, the life, the gods of the overmind can experience harmony. But the supramental divine experiences perfect unity. There is a difference between the two. And that difference is in the fact that that which experiences perfect unity can become whatever it wants by will, while that which is constrained by harmony can know its identity with other things, but cannot become that by will.
Thank you.
Devashishtha, it seems that, I mean, somehow I feel that's a very, from where we are, from where I am, it seems like a very subtle difference, no? Like, you identify with something, but you cannot become it.
Yeah, because you see, the real change that takes place from the supermind to the overmind is a change of Shakti. At the peaks of overmind, one may say that the being of supermind is still present, but the Shakti of overmind has changed. So the capacity, the power has been constrained. A certain limitation in power has taken place, not necessarily in being.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha.